From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, sex, violence, prejudice, and crime in the films of the silent era. A talk with silent film historian Kevin Brownlow, who says silence weren't as innocent as you think. He's not only written books on the silence, he restored the 1927 silent epic, Napoleon. Also today, photographer Richard Mizrach proposes turning a Navy bombing range in the Nevada desert into a national park. World music critic Milo Miles plays us some zouk, music popular in France, derived from the French Caribbean. And critic Maureen Corrigan goes to the Museum of Modern Art to see the High-Low Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House announced today that NATO forces in Europe will dispatch an aircraft squadron to Turkey in hopes of deterring a possible Iraqi attack. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
NATO ambassadors meeting in Brussels approved a request by the Turkish government for aircraft support from its fellow treaty members. The move marks the first time the alliance has made a military commitment to forces in the Persian Gulf. Some 40 fighter aircraft from Italy, Germany, and Belgium will be sent to Turkey next week. The aircraft squadron is usually attached to a 5,000-strong NATO multinational brigade, but Turkey did not request ground troops. The White House called it a demonstration of NATO solidarity with Turkey in the Persian Gulf crisis. Turkey shares a border with Iraq. The move also marks the first time that NATO has committed air power to help defend an ally in a crisis. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
President Bush said today that he'll continue the nation's economic sanctions against Libya. In a letter to Congress, the president said that Libya still supports international terrorism. Libyan assets in the U.S. were frozen under the terms of a national emergency declared in 1986. The president said that the threat to U.S. security and foreign policy interests has not been resolved. He said it was necessary to keep economic pressure on Libya. Somalia's president has called for an end to fighting between government troops and rebels. He made the appeal over Radio Mogadishu today. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department has ordered the evacuation of all U.S. diplomats and private American citizens from the country. George Guetta reports.
There are 37 official Americans and fewer than 50 private U.S. citizens in Somalia. The State Department said all will leave once officials are convinced they can be evacuated safely. Once the official Americans depart Somalia, the embassy there is expected to be designated open but unstaffed, the same status given to the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait, from which Americans were evacuated 3 weeks ago. Hundreds of Somalians, many of them civilians, have been reported killed in several days of fighting. Rebels want to end the 21-year rule of President Siad Barre, who was once a close U.S. ally. Somalia's importance to the United States has diminished over the years because of the decline of the Cold War, as well as human rights abuses and a general climate of instability. Most U.S. assistance was suspended in 1989. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
The National Weather Service says that flooding is expected to continue through Saturday in parts of Indiana and Ohio. Flood warnings remain in effect for the Kankakee and the Wabash rivers, and waters aren't expected to crest downstream for several days. Many cities in Indiana and Ohio reported 7 to 10 inches of rain in December, topping off a year that was the wettest on record for much of the region. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 23 points today to close at 2,610.6 FAR. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The silent film era has been celebrated for its innocence, but my guest Kevin Brownlow says the silent era has also recorded another America: gangsters, corrupt politicians, syphilis discrimination, unemployment, and poverty. Brownlow's new book, Behind the Mask of Innocence, is an attempt to set the record straight by examining films of social conscience in the silent era. For the most part, these are films that had been virtually forgotten until Brownlow rediscovered them. Brownlow is one of the world's leading silent film historians. He also collects and restores silent films. He restored Abel Gance's 1927 silent epic, Napoleon. MGM, the original American distributor, hacked the film down from 6 hours to 80 minutes. Napoleon went pretty much unnoticed until, after years of detective work, tracking down missing footage, Brownlow presented his restoration in 1980. He also produced a trilogy of films on Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and Harold Lloyd, which you may have seen on public television. I asked Kevin Brownlow why he loved silent films.
I think it's because I was a kid at school and they used to show us films every third weekend, and they couldn't afford talking pictures, and so they showed us silence. And although I wasn't then so impressed by the films themselves, what fascinated me was the fact that you could have a cinema in your own home, you could have a movie theatre in your own home. And so I badgered my parents to get me a projector, and I got one for my 11th birthday, and only two films came with it, and they both only lasted 2 minutes. So I started hunting for more, and I found a whole pile of silent films in a shop off Baker Street, and brought them back and ran them to my parents. And my mother recognized Douglas Fairbanks and William S. Hart and Bessie Love, all the stars that she'd grown up with. So I thought, this must be worth something. So I went to the library, took out a book on the history of the cinema, and it fell open at a picture of the Douglas Fairbanks film I had. And so that persuaded me that there must be some value in these films. And gradually, I found more and more of them and discovered that they were extremely well made and extremely well photographed and actually more interesting as films than some of the stuff I was looking at in the local cinema.
It's so remarkable to me that you could have found footage, in junk stores and, you know, local fairs and things like that.
These were prepared for home movie use. They were abridged versions of complete features. And there were some very rare things on them. And two of the reels I found were from a film called Napoleon. But the American films impressed me tremendously, both for their vitality and their technical perfection at a very early date. And so I started researching. As a matter of fact, I was supposed to do sport at school every afternoon. Instead of that, I went to the British Film Institute and began looking them up in old magazines. And that was a thrilling detective work because they had actually changed the titles for home movie use. So you had to find out what they were by a process of trial and error and just ploughing through all the releases till you found the description that matched.
This is fascinating to me. I mean, who could have afforded to have a projector at home to show the movies? I didn't realize they were shown at home.
Yes, they were quite cheap little projectors. They turned by handle, and you had the films lasted anything from 2 minutes to 10 minutes a reel, and you could sometimes get quite long films. In fact, there was a version of Les Misérables I discovered of 9 reels, which was absolutely stupendous, and you were turning the handle all the time.
Well, you get exercise while you're watching the movie.
That's right.
Well, a little later, I want to get back to some of the detective work you've done in your collecting of movies, and we'll talk also about how you pieced together the epic Napoleon. But now I want to talk a little bit about your new book, Behind the Mask of Innocence. In your new book, you write that silent films are usually seen as representing an era of innocence, but they didn't really.
That's right. As you asked me what turned me on to silent films in the first place, when I became a filmmaker, I felt that they had been slandered, that people regarded them as jerky, flickering, technically inept curiosities, and I wanted to change that picture. And then as I researched them, I found that the prevailing mood was one of sentimental nonsense, hokum, as the Americans called it, melodrama, and that however well-made the film was, people tended to dismiss the story as being ridiculous and antique and quaint. And I felt that there must have been films made about social issues of the time. There must have been films about the immigrants, and there must have been films about women's suffrage and things like that. I must say it took a long time to find any evidence of them. But once I did, it turned into an avalanche, and I was absolutely staggered that so many films were made that we know so little about, and alas, most of them have been destroyed.
Where did you go looking for them when you knew there was a certain theme that you were looking for?
Well, there were two routes I took. One was into the libraries so that you look up the reviews of the time and read the reviews carefully. And I had some marvelous help from historians in America who kept their eyes open as well. And then the other route was through collections. When collectors died, for instance, in Holland, somebody inherited an enormous 700,000 feet of nitrate. And again, the title's hidden under Dutch titles. But you had to do the detective work to work out what the film was called in the first place. But among them was the most remarkable picture called Where Are My Children, made in 1916, which was by a woman director called Lois Weber. And it was supporting Margaret Sanger's campaign for birth control, but it was opposed to abortion. And that was the reason for the title of the picture. However, when it reached Europe was in the middle of the First World War, and it didn't agree with birth control at all. So it completely recut the picture, retitled it, changed the story and the theme. And you can see one version in the Library of Congress in Washington, which is Lois Weber's original, and you can see the other version, which is as it reached Europe. And I thought that was an extraordinary twist to a picture which, again, is unknown, alas, but it should be better known.
It certainly is extraordinary. My guest is Kevin Brownlow, who's really one of the world's leading authorities on silent films, and his new book is called Behind the Mask of Innocence: Sex, Violence, Prejudice, Crime, Films of Social Conscience in the Silent Era. You know, the early silent movies raise a lot of interesting questions when you're talking about social films, because some of those films have to do with violence or sexuality. And this is the first time that people started asking questions about the degree of explicit sexuality or explicit crime that was going to be shown on the screen and what effect that would have on the people who saw it. What were some of the early ways those questions were raised, and what were some of the early fears that were expressed?
Well, right from the very start, when pictures first began to move, people started using them as an excuse. And the great train robbery of 1903, you can't get much earlier as far as story films go than that, already a young offender said, I was influenced by that picture to do this terrible crime. If I hadn't seen that film, I wouldn't have done it. and so the churchmen and the women's clubs, they started getting rather anxious about these pictures. And in 1906, I think it was, Harry Thaw shot the famous architect Stanford White when he discovered that his wife had been his mistress before they were married. And this scandal made many people turn it into a film. One of them, I think, came out 2 days after the event. And this series of films were the first to show the working class and immigrant audiences how the upper crust lived. And these were the people who made their laws and control their lives, and the middle classes were shocked that such things could be viewed by ordinary working people, and so it made them, the Thaw films made them shut theatres down.
So the earlier censorship that you're talking about is really what precedes the Hays Office and the Hollywood Production Code.
Yes, Hays didn't come in until 1921, 1922. And he was brought in because there was a series of scandals in Hollywood which threatened the family audience. The studio heads realized that unless they did something, they would lose that vital audience. And they did what the baseball people did when the World Series was fixed. They brought in a neutral figure who became known as the Tsar of all the Russias. And he really did a lot of harm because he emasculated stories which would otherwise have been getting stronger all the time, getting more interesting, more political and more engaged, and he made them blander. So that the great period of social films, where virtually every subject under the sun was tackled, was before his arrival up to 1921.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about silent movies. And my guest is Kevin Brownlow, and he's really one of the world's experts on silent films, and he has a new book on the subject called Behind the Mask of Innocence: Sex, Violence, Prejudice, Crime, Films of Social Conscience in the Silent Era. You might also know Kevin Brownlow as one of the people who restored the 1927 silent film classic Napoleon. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. talking about silent films with Kevin Brownlow, who's joining us from the NPR Bureau in London. Well, during your search for issue films from the silent film era, you managed to find some pornographic films from the era. And I'd love to hear where you found them, what they were like, where they were shown.
Well, these were always amateur-made, and they were the one I found, the first one I found anyway, was sold at a film convention in Los Angeles as a D.W. Griffith biograph, which I think is extremely unfair. It clearly wasn't, and it was obviously made by somebody who had access to a 35mm movie camera, probably about 1923, and very badly made. All of them are excruciatingly badly made. But I often have a sneaking suspicion, particularly on the continent in Germany, that it was the thought that they could actually make sexual images move that helped the invention of the cinema. So they go back right to the very beginning, and they're always just terrible. I don't think anyone's from any of those are worth looking at.
Terrible filmically, sexually, how are they terrible?
Every point of view, you can hardly see them. Of course, they've been copied so often. And they just show sex was performed in exactly the same way as it is, even though this was supposed to be the age of innocence. But the much funnier are the little softcore films, which were sold in 100-foot rolls, 16mm under the counter in the 20s. And there was one called The Finishing School, and there are a bunch of girls playing strip poker, and suddenly they're at a finishing school. A headmistress bursts in and says, "This is in the title. This is a finishing school, and you are all finished."
So, where did you find the films?
Well, funnily enough, one set of those films turned up in a air raid shelter in London, along with I think there was a revolver and a hand grenade there as well. So the fellow that owned them must have felt very protective about them. But much more interesting than those actually are the films that were made for the public on sexual issues, such as venereal disease, particularly in this age of the AIDS plague. It's fascinating to see what happened with those. They started making them for the army, and they were made with no holds barred. I mean, you cannot look at some of the images in those of the wounds, the sores. It's simply appalling. Then they were remade when the troops came home after the First World War, bringing a VD epidemic with them. They started showing them in theatres, and once again, the reformers felt this simply wasn't on. This could not happen. Sex education was absolutely out of the question because it encouraged people to do what they saw on the screen. That was the naive idea. And there was such a fuss made about them that the Surgeon General withdrew them. He would rather ignorance than ignominy. And so VD just spread like wildfire.
You know what I'm wondering? Say, 1950s and early 1960s juvenile delinquency films in the States. And these are like films that are a lot of fun in a lot of ways, right? But they'd always be preceded by a message, either from a narrator or on a crawl, you know, on the screen, that would explain that this could happen in your neighborhood. No youth was safe, and if we didn't take precautions, this is what would happen. So the film kind of posed as presenting a cautionary message, when in fact it was just an exploitation film. Did you find that kind of thing happening in the silent era, where under the banner of a cautionary message, you were actually getting to see lots of sex or lots of violence and, you know, other thrilling scenes?
Yes, there's that definitely was established early in the silent days. Exploitation films were certainly made, and they were made with those endless crawl titles, as you call them, or a doctor coming on and with an endless series of titles telling you what to think. And in fact, a lot of money changed hands for learned professors with lots of letters after their name to put their approval, their seal of approval on the film. And people learned to start darting out of the cinema as soon as those endless titles came on.
And what about some of the films about poverty? Were some of those not really so much social issue movies as tearjerkers?
Yes, of course they were, but there were also many crusading pictures saying this should not happen in our society and showing you a kind of poverty which we've forgotten exists. Many of them were shot on the Lower East Side or in the slums of the big cities, and they serve as incredible historical documents. But by far the greatest was a film of the late 20s called The Crowd, made by King Vidor with Eleanor Boardman, who was then his wife, and James Murray. And it's a picture as though it was made in the thick of the Depression, but it was made at the height of Coolidge prosperity. And it was showed a man who just couldn't hold down a job and what happened to him. And it is a masterpiece, and you could not do it better. And in fact, when King Vidor went to Italy and met Vittorio De Sica, he said it was seeing The Crowd that made him make The Bicycle Thief.
Hmm. Kevin Brownlow is my guest. He's an expert on silent films. He restored the 1927 film, silent film classic Napoleon, and he's the author of a new book about social films of the silent film era called Behind the Mask of Innocence. I think all of the silent films were made on nitrate film, which has a fairly short shelf life. Can you explain what the problem is with nitrate film, the problems with storage, and the problems with durability?
Yes, nitrate is known to be very inflammable, and as a result, people have created a scare. To such an extent, studios and private collectors have thrown it out. They won't have it anywhere near them in case it explodes like a hand grenade. But in fact, it's been an awful lot of nonsense being talked about it, because you drive around in a car with petrol in your tank, you don't set light to that, and it's no more dangerous than that. However, it can decompose because it's got animal fat in its makeup. And this is the most distressing aspect of it. It was expected to last 50 years, and the silent era itself was history 60 years ago. So we're talking about film which has miraculously lasted, and there's not a, you know, about two-thirds of the silent era is already lost. So we're talking about the remaining third. Some of that has already been copied by archives onto safety stock. Now, the rest of it must be done, because this is the last decade of nitrate, and if we don't do it, posterity will regard it as one of the greatest cultural crimes.
Well, I think one of the things you're proving is that we really don't fully know what the silent film era was like, since so much of the movies have been lost.
Particularly those years before the 20s started. We have, during that period, there was something called the three-reeler that was very popular. And the three-reeler, because it was an awkward length, was never kept, and hardly any of them survive, and yet the most interesting subjects were made in that peculiar length. It lasted, you know, about half an hour, 40 minutes, depending the speed you ran it at. And some remarkable pictures were produced, and some series about capital versus labor, and about the early gangsters, and the patent medicine racket, and it's absolutely fascinating.
You know, speaking to you is really getting me enthusiastic about going to the video store and renting some silent films, and more of them are coming out on video. I'll be honest with you, I've never rented a silent film on video. It always seems like it will be an incomplete experience watching it on a small screen without music, or at least without live music. I wonder if you've had the experience of watching silence on video and what you think of it.
Well, I think watching films on video is an incomplete experience. I think a whole generation has lost the thrill of seeing a picture in the cinema as it was meant to be seen, with an audience reacting strongly to it and adding that reaction to their own. And then they look at the same film. If you look at the same film on video, it's never anything like the same. However, there are some excellent examples on video. In fact, my partner and I, my partner David Gill and I, have prepared some, including Ben-Hur, the 1925 Raymond Navarro version, and Carl Davis has written a fantastic score for it, the Garbo film Flesh and the Devil, quite a number of them, King Vidor's The Crowd, and King Vidor's Show People, which is one of the funniest pictures of that period. So there are some fine pictures available on video, but they should be done with the best possible quality and also the best quality score. And that sometimes lets it down. Sometimes you get a silent film which is ghastly quality in every sense. The music, too, is just a piano. But that brings me back to the thing that got me going in the first place, that it was the technical perfection of these films which amazed me, that photographically they were always extremely good. And it's the copying over the years that has made them look, he's given them that murky look. And alas, videotape is not the ideal medium for them. You should really see a really good print projected with a with an arc or with a really good light behind it on a big screen, and preferably live music.
You restored the 1927 French silent film Napoleon, which was directed by Abel Gance. I'm sure a lot of detective work went into finding the film. I think you'd said that you saw the first part of it when you were around 11 years old, but that was just a small, just a couple of minutes that you saw, right?
No, it was a couple of reels, which would have lasted 20, 25 minutes, and it was enough to convince me that this was some of the finest filmmaking I'd ever seen. I go out on a limb and say it was the finest filmmaking I'd ever seen, and if the rest of the film is as good as that, then it, you know, I must get the rest of it. Well, it took years and years and years, but it was one of the most extraordinary things. The more I found, the better the picture got, until the version that we're running in Europe now is 5 hours 13.
Well, that's longer than the version that was in the States a few years ago, isn't it?
Considerably longer, yes. Yes, it is. And we're constantly finding more.
Where are you finding more and more footage from this?
Well, now footage is being dredged up from the archives of the Cinémathèque Française, and is not a great deal, but there's another 5 minutes to be sneaked in somehow, if we can afford to do it. But every time you put more footage in, you have to pay to change the score. And if I could tell you that it costs £2,000 just to Xerox the score, you can see how expensive it is.
At this point, is your version of Napoleon longer than what Abel Gance originally had in mind?
No, it isn't. Gance was forced to show a shorter version at the premiere, and it was about 3.5 hours. It sort of approximated to the version that's shown in America. After that, he showed an expanded version, and that, as far as we can gather, was more than 7 hours. So there's still quite a lot of it lost, and I don't think it'll ever be found at this late date. People think it's going to be an effort to sit through it, but it isn't. It sweeps you along with it, because the more you put back, the more explanation is given, the more innovation you see, and the more exciting it becomes.
What are you working on now?
David Gill and I are now working on a documentary for American Masters on D.W. Griffith.
That should be very interesting. What are you focusing on?
Well, the whole career. It's going to be 3 programs. And so we're desperately trying to find people who worked with him and who knew him. So if anyone is listening to this who worked with Griffith and we haven't interviewed you, please let us know.
Okay. Kevin Brownlow, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Kevin Brownlow's new book is Behind the Mask of Innocence. Next time, how scientists are searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. I'm Terry Grosson. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Richard Mizrach has photographed a desolate, barren landscape that's been ravaged by decades of bombing. But that landscape's not some distant battlefield. It's an area of Nevada desert now known as Bravo 20. For 30 years, the U.S. Navy's used the area for bombing practice. Coming up, Mizrach proposes turning Bravo 20 into an environmental park. We should have been dancing to Zouk music by now. At least that's what a lot of world music fans were saying a few years ago. World music critic Milo Miles introduces us to Zouk and tells us why it didn't catch on. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the Museum of Modern Art's High-Low Show. It's a look at how fine arts have been influenced by popular culture and vice versa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. NATO has agreed to send some 40 warplanes to Turkey to serve as a deterrent to any possible threat from Iraq if war breaks out in the Persian Gulf. This move comes after request from the government of Turkey for deployment of the airplanes. Jonathan Marcus of the BBC has more.
Turkey is the only NATO country that shares a common border with Iraq. It also hosts a number of important U.S. bases, and the Turkish government is clearly worried that if fighting erupts in the Gulf, Iraq may threaten a strike against its territory. The aircraft, over 40 in number, will come from Belgium, Germany and Italy. This is a rapidly deployable military body. Its purpose is to demonstrate the alliance's solidarity and determination to resist any potential threat to the territory of one of its members. A NATO spokesman stressed the defensive nature of the move. The deployment is of diplomatic and political significance rather than of great military importance. The aircraft involved should begin arriving in Turkey in about 4 days' time, and all should be in place by the 10th of January.
Jonathan Marcus of the BBC. In Iraq, thousands of 17-year-olds have started reporting for military duty under government order. The age for military service in the country had been 18. Also today, the Iraqi government said that it has approved a pay raise for the country's army. Government officials in Iraq say the nation has a new early warning airplane to find approaching enemy aircraft. Henry Power, a former British Army medic, was called up to active duty in the Persian Gulf on New Year's Eve. Today, he said, he would not go. Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
Power, a 43-year-old psychiatric nurse, left the Royal Army Medical Corps 12 years ago. He was called up under the terms of Britain's Territorial and Reserves Act. Power, from Scotland, said, quote, "The Gulf is not a British war." He added, "If the Americans want to take a gung-ho attitude and go out there and fight, that's entirely up to them." Power received support from Labour Member of Parliament Tam Dyel, who said, quote, "The purpose of the Territorial and Reserves Act is the defense of the British Islands, not to form part of an Anglo-American expeditionary force on course for a horrendous war." Power said he would report to barracks as ordered on Saturday and would wait and see what happens. He is considering registering as a conscientious objector. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Goldfarb in London.
In Florida, according to an industry group, about a third of the orange crop in Florida had been picked by the end of last month. At this time last year, three-fourths of the harvest was still in the trees. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 23 points to close at 2,610.64 on volume of some 127 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, Maureen Corrigan reviews the High-Low Show at the Museum of Modern Art. Musical and dance styles from the Caribbean have swelled on our shores with varying degrees of force. Calypso is big, and reggae hasn't done bad. World music commentator Milo Miles tells us the Caribbean dance music, known as Zouk, got to be big in Europe and Africa, but never quite made it here. But he says that's no reason not to still enjoy it.
No major type of popular music can be said to have arrived unless it generates a next big thing, and probably a next big thing that doesn't ultimately happen. World music took that big step forward back around 1987. The buzz among fans was that very shortly, all African-derived world music would be sucked up in a hot new style called Zouk. Its roots lay in the French Caribbean, it had been refined and polished in Paris, and it synthesized music from Africa, America, Haiti, and all over the place. The strange thing was that for a music with such complex sources, most of it was being played by a single brilliant band called Kassav. The founders of the group, Georges Desimus and Jacob Desvelieu, had met in Paris in the late 70s and decided to put together all their varied influences into the most high-tech Caribbean dance madness they could manage, and tout le monde would love it. In short, their Zouk was the first music consciously created by and for the emerging world music environment. Other outfits were moving along the same lines, but Kassav took experiments and drop-dead ensemble precision further than anyone else. Outside the United States, their breakthrough came in 1983 with an intricate, infectious song called, in translation, Zouk is the only medicine we have.
One way.
One way Kassav managed to virtually corner the Zouk market was that they took a page from Frank Zappa and George Clinton and began recording scads of separate albums using the names of band members or outright pseudonyms. The nicest result of this practice was that singer Jocelyn Beauregard scored a crossover pop hit called Siwo, which means sweet, that turned out to be the most alluring of all slower Zouk tunes. Naturally, other Caribbean bands besides Kassav excel at Zouk. One of the most respected is Gasoline, led by the flamboyant singer Pierre Rossier. But until now, the richest and toughest Gasoline albums were hard to find in this country. Shaughnessy Records has solved that problem with the best of Gasoline collection called Zouk Obsession. You notice the springy rhythms and relentless momentum of Gasoline is similar to Kassav. But in place of the ever-increasing technological sheen of Kassav, Gasoline will throw in a homey touch like a banjo solo or a bit of harmonica extravaganza. Finally, for those who want a sample of Zouk before plunging in, there are a couple of marvelous anthologies. One is Hurricane Zouk, which emphasizes sophisticated, flashy Zouk with fancy production values. The other is Dance Cadence, which includes spiffy numbers from principal players like Kassav, as well as some more traditional stylists that help shape Zouk. Either collection should get the hippest partygoers wiggling their scruples away. So if Zouk is such a smart and sassy concoction, why is it the next big thing in world music that never happened? Well, Zouk lost a lot of oomph in the last couple of years simply because it failed to develop much stylistically or commercially. Once Kassav and a few of their peers got up to full speed with sparkling sound and tight dynamics, nobody could find any place to go. And far too many mediocre Kassav imitators churned out dozens of useless sound-alike albums. Zouk colored pop music all over the Caribbean, Africa, and Paris, and Kassav even signed with Epic in the United States. Then, nobody could figure out how to promote them, and sales remained low. Word of mouth failed to save Zouk, and now the verdict looks like, nope, no big thing this time. Maybe the major snag, especially for those who don't speak French, is that Zouk usually suggests nothing more and nothing less than the world's most intoxicating dance froth. And right now, the prejudice is for adult pop with serious, heavy, important vibes. But that shouldn't stop you from enjoying Zouk. In fact, it's more fun than ever now that it doesn't have to conquer the universe.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Depuis 5 heures matin, rive tout le monde avec moi travail. Pouillot et sa gagner, on dit l'argent. Même si tu n'y misère, nous toutes nous là, nous t'a aimé. Avec espoir un jour, ça qui changé. This is Fresh Air. Richard Mizrach's current series of desert photographs resembles a scene from the post-apocalyptic movie Road Warrior. The crater-pocked landscape is barren except for blown-out vehicles, twisted metal shrapnel, and unexploded bombs. This area of the northern Nevada desert has been used by the Navy as a test bombing range on and off since the 1940s. Mizrach has been photographing scenes from American deserts since the mid-70s. This latest series is called Bravo 20. The name assigned by the Navy to the Nevada site. The Bravo 20 photos have been on exhibit in Nevada since November. The photos are also collected in a book called Bravo 20 that includes a history of the area and a proposal to turn the bomb site into an environmental park. In the introduction to his book, Mizrach describes the area as a place of great beauty and great horror side by side.
Bravo 20 bombing range, it's set in the vast Carson Sink in northwestern Nevada, and it's a huge alkali flat, sort of like a billboard table that's just covered with talcum powder. It's beautifully flat, and it's got a wonderful quality to it. And then right in the center of this vast alkali flat is a 160-foot tall volcanic plug, which is actually a Northern Pirate ritual site. And it's a really unusual geologic features, and the light and the space, it's sort of classic desert, and it's quite beautiful. And layered over that is the horror of our devastation, just flung upon this beautiful landscape, which is just thousands of craters and bombs and metal, shrapnel from exploded bombs and targets.
How much time did you spend in Bravo 20?
I began photographing in 1986, and what I would do with my dog Kodak is we'd go out and camp for maybe 2, 3, 4 days at a time, photograph, and then come back out. And over the next year and a half, I would continue back.
Was it legal for you to be there?
Well, interestingly enough, in 1985, a friend discovered that in fact, Bravo 20 was public land and that the Navy had been bombing it illegally. And they created a camp in and a protest to bring that to public attention. And in fact, it was public land. So from 1985 to 1986, since it was public land, I had all the rights to be there, and in fact, the Navy didn't have the right to bomb it. So I was legally there, and then at the end of 1986, the Military Lands Withdrawal Act of 1986 was passed and signed into law, giving Bravo 20 to the Navy legally to use. However, I had purchased part of a mining claim that we took out on Bravo 20 right in the center of the target, and the 1872 mining law preempted the new national law, and in fact, my mining claim was good. So we sent a letter to the Navy saying that we'd be out there mining our claim day and night, and that they could not begin bombing, and this would be their only notice. So I was able to photograph into 1987 as well, and it wasn't until 1988 that the Navy went ahead and condemned our claim, forcing us out. But we are contesting that claim in courts.
During the time when you were photographing in the area of Bravo 20, were you afraid of detonating bombs that had been unexploded?
Initially, I was very afraid of those. I was terrified. In fact, when I was first taken out there, I had no interest in staying overnight at all. But my friends who had been out there many times told me that it really wasn't that dangerous. And they told, there's a number of signs to look for. There's certain bombs that were practice or dummy bombs and certain ones that were live. And for instance, the live bombs were supposed to have either what's called alligator skin or yellow stripes on them or a fuse intact. And the dummy bombs were painted blue and were different. But the problem was, is being in the desert for any period of time, a lot of those signs sort of wore off and you couldn't really tell. So I was just very careful out there. And after spending a couple of terrifying nights out there, I found that nothing went off and it was fine.
You are proposing that America make the area of Bravo 20 into an environmental park. What would be the purpose of the park?
The idea behind the park, it's actually one that at first was sort of a vehicle for satire, but it's taken on, become very serious for me. Just like the Vietnam Memorial, there's been thousands of war memorials since the beginning of time, and very few of them are memorable or significant in a sense. But the Vietnam War Memorial has become a very profound monument, both to the men that have lost their lives, but also to the dark period of the Vietnam War. And I think we've hit such an incredible environmental crisis. We have nothing like that for the environment. We have no environmental memorial. And I think that Bravo 20 has become a big metaphor, both for military expansionism, but also for the way we've sort of abused the environment in a dramatic way, that it actually would be a very important educational center.
Well, your suggestions include an area called Devastation Drive, Boardwalk of the Bombs, and a display that will call attention to the Navy's flawed environmental studies. This doesn't really sound like the type of thing the government's going to get behind to, you know, declare a national park.
Obviously it's not the kind of thing that the Navy or the government's going to be particularly sympathetic to, because it is embarrassing on one hand. On the other hand, the idea now is to first of all make the issues known and the problems known. And I think the way the national park idea is fleshed out both in the exhibition and in the book, it does sort of detail how it would actually function well. I know it's a little close to home right now, and I can't imagine anybody embracing this right now. So right now it'll have to suffice as an idea. But you'd be amazed, the response for the exhibition in Nevada that recently opened has received a tremendous amount of response, public response, media response, and the people in Nevada are very much have taken the project, the national park idea, very seriously and embrace it. So I think that remains to be seen how it sort of takes on over the next 10 years. The proposal is for the year 2001.
And that's the year that the military loses its rights to Bravo 20.
What happens is the rights to bomb, they have a 15-year period now where they can use the range as a bombing range. In the year 2001, it does go before Congress again, and the military and Congress will need to talk about what the future use will be. My idea is sort of an opposition, a sort of a alternative use of Bravo 20 that would serve the public. Since it was taken illegally from the public domain in the first place, I think it should be returned to the public domain. Now, there is another possibility, which would be to just let Bravo 20 reclaim itself, let the desert sort of take itself back over and just turn it back into a desert reserve. But I thought about that a lot, and I thought that it might actually serve all desert places or environment better if it was turned into a place of education as well.
In your proposal to turn Bravo 20 into an environmental park, mm-hmm. you suggest that, of course, like in all parks, there needs to be a gift shop. What would you envision being in the gift shop? Your photos, right. Maybe?
Actually, we should have some, instead of posters of Yosemite under snow, maybe bomb-covered landscapes. But seriously, it's been sort of the fun part of that has been that the Bravo 20 National Park is a little bit of a poke at the national park system as well. Generally, the national parks have sort of focused on the spectacular landscapes, the geological wonders of the United States, like Yosemite or Death Valley. But one of the points about turning Bravo 20 into a national park is the idea that there's the other landscapes with which we live or are involved, the less spectacular ones need to be paid attention to as well. And in my exploration of that whole idea, I looked at the gift shops in the national parks, and they're really pretty tacky. you find matches with pictures of Half Dome Monument and things like that. So what I did is I've designed, since every national park has to have a visitor center, and then the visitor center has a gift shop, I figured I would follow through with the whole idea. So our gift shop, the Bravo Twine National Park gift shop, will have serious things from films and books on military issues, but it'll also have some fun things. So I've designed a number of things like camouflage porta potty salt and pepper shakers, no first strike matches where you open up the matches and all the heads are cut off, camouflage tote bags and T-shirts and so forth. And one of my favorites, which I've is part of the exhibit, I've actually have display cases showing these things. I've actually had these designed and made. And I have Bravo Twin National Park bolo ties, which are quite beautiful, made from corroding metal in the shape of Nevada. So it's been a little tongue-in-cheek, but actually one of the things about this whole, using ideas like Devastation Drive and Boardwalk of the Bombs, or even the visitor center gift shop items, the humor is a really powerful delivery system, pun intended, for getting across ideas that are a little bit dark. And also the beauty of the photographs has been something I've thought about a lot. If anything, I have been accused of aestheticizing some of the horrific practices of our military, but I really do believe that these issues are hard to take on, and that maybe the beauty that I employ with the photography and the humor with the national park drawings and concepts is a way of getting across a very serious idea.
What's your next trip to the desert going to be?
Aha. What I've been doing is I've been working on two series side by side. Some of these darker, more bleak things, which is like the Dead Animal Pit or the Bravo 20 work, which is in some respects very depressing. And I've also been doing very lyrical, beautiful things in the Black Rock Desert, or even a series on clouds, which is just purely lyrical, just so I don't forget why I'm photographing all these bleak things. But the most recent series has been, I found two Playboy magazines that were used for target practice near the nuclear test site. And it's very upsetting. It's probably the most upsetting work in a sense, because although the women on the covers were the intended targets, all aspects of American culture, as reflected inside the magazines, were riddled with violence. Everything from race, gender, class, even language itself were riddled with bullets. So this has been the most recent metaphor that I've worked on.
Photographer Richard Mizrach. His new book, Bravo 20, The Bombing of the American West, is a collection of photos taken at the Bravo 20 bombing site in the Nevada desert. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. On the Gulf crisis, NATO is sending troops to the Gulf. We'll have a story on that and a report from Baghdad, where the shortages of food are beginning to bite. The Congress is coming back to be sworn in, and we'll have some discussion about what's ahead for them and what, if anything, they plan to say about the Gulf. We have two big features today, one on ethnocentric education in Chicago and one on a form of gospel singing called Jubilee.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York that seems to have divided the art world. It's called High and Low, Modern Art and Popular Culture. Over the holidays, we sent critic Maureen Carrigan to see it, and she has this review.
You've got to like a museum show that's managed to raise the hackles of almost every art critic in New York. Conservative Hilton Kramer wrote that he suffered physical revulsion upon visiting the High-Low show. Apparently, the sight of newspaper clippings sharing the same rarefied airspace as cubist masterpieces was too much for Kramer to stomach. Leftist critics have complained that the show doesn't go far enough to dismantle traditional hierarchies. They point out that comic books huddle in glass cases below the lofty paintings and sculpture they inspired. Maybe I read too many of these angry reviews, because when I toured the High-Low show last week, I felt perversely pleased with everything I saw. Sure, there are problems, especially with the show's bend-over-backwards, earnest attitude towards popular culture. Imagine Bill Moyers interviewing the California Raisins, and you'll have something of the tone of the show's discussion of graffiti and billboards. But flawed as it is, the High-Low Show does a wonderful job of investigating how ideas and forms circulate between popular culture and high art. The show is divided into four sections that illustrate the influence of advertising, graffiti, caricature, and comics on modern artists. You see how Marcel Duchamp got the idea for turning ready-made urinals and bicycle wheels into art from the way shopkeepers began to isolate objects in their display windows in the 1920s. Duchamp was laughing at how art and business both exploit the magnetism of the solitary object. Jean Miró transformed catalog drawings of silverware into the weird, biomorphic creatures that dance in his paintings. And the show also encourages masterpieces like Picasso's portrait of Gertrude Stein and Miró's dog barking at the moon to acknowledge their poor relations, caricatures, and cartoons. The brave aphorism on the front page of the High-Low Show's program justifies this jumble of images. It says, "There's nothing so sacred that it may not be profaned, but nothing so profane that it may not be made, in a sense, sacred. These days, them's fightin' words." The outcry against the High-Low Show sounds awfully familiar to me. It parallels the canon debate that's been raging in the academic world for a while now. The most recent conservative salvo has been lobbed by Alvin Kernan in his book, The Death of Literature. Kernan is in that crowd that says that literature is doomed, a victim of the low art form of TV and the combined assault of Freudians, Marxists, deconstructionists, feminists, and gays. This mob, he says, wants to transform Moby Dick from a spiritual quest into a portrayal of masculine individualism gone mad. Imagine. Kernan, Hilton Kramer, and their queasy colleagues are afraid that great art might actually have some connection to society after all. Admit that, and the barbarians are at the gates, wanting to claim art for their own purposes. The High-Low Show cracks the door of that intriguing possibility open a little wider.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. The High-Low Show is at the Museum of Modern Art in New York till January 15th. It opens at the Art Institute of Chicago next month and at the Museum of Contemporary Art in L.A. this June. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person, with production assistance from Joan Tui, Roberta Sherrock, and Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, is there anyone out there? Frank White updates us on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And we meet Anne Magnuson, one of the few performance artists, perhaps the only one, to star in a sitcom. She'll perform an excerpt of one of her new pieces. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.